This is David Marsh in London speaking to Sir Charles Bean, a very well-known economist, Charlie Bean, who was the deputy governor of the Bank of England the last time we had a really big crisis back in 2008-2009. Charlie Bean is now a lecturer at the London School of Economics and is also part of the Office for Budgetary Responsibility, which looks after the British government's finances and keeps a watch on it. And there's going to be a lot of borrowing coming up as a result of this crisis. So, Charlie, thanks very much for being on the line. First of all, what distinguishes this crisis from the last one that you had to deal with when you were at the Bank of England, the great financial crisis of 2008-2009?
Well, the first thing to say is that the nature of the shock is a very different one. The financial crisis obviously took place after a build-up of financial imbalances and accumulation of debt and fragilities in the financial system, with many financial institutions having over-leveraged balance sheets. And the financial crisis, of course, actually took quite a while to unfold. It started in mid-2007, and we had periodic institution failures, and then, of course, the collapse of Lehman's a year later in September 2008, which then precipitated the near seizure of financial markets and the subsequent Great Recession, which has taken a very long time to recover from. And the reason it takes such a long time to recover from banking crises is that there's usually these imbalances that have to be worked off and corrected, and it takes a long time, and there's obviously often issues about who bears the losses and so forth. And there's lots of empirical evidence that perhaps we should have known at the time of the financial crisis, but people like Ken Rogoff and Carmen Reinhart and Schulerich and Taylor have accumulated to demonstrate this regularity that recovery from financial and banking crises is very slow. This crisis is very different because it doesn't reflect a fundamental underlying problem in the UK or any other economy. It's an exogenous event, an act of God, or maybe we should call it an act of chance rather than an act of God, in the form of the coronavirus. And in the nature of the necessary response to the health crisis involving enforcing limited interaction between individuals, encouraging people to work at home, all of those sorts of things, leads to very significant economic disruption. But in principle, it should be a relatively short but very sharp shock. Quite how short will obviously be linked to how long it takes to get a vaccine ready or appropriate antiviral drugs which are effective against the coronavirus. But there isn't the same underlying structural problem in economies which will need to be corrected.
Charlie, and in a way I'm quite pleased to hear somebody with a sanguine view, but on the other hand, lots of central bankers, including Mark Carney, the departing governor of the Bank of England, has made quite clear that we don't have a huge amount of ammunition left to combat crises of any sort, whether endogenous or exogenous, and we're not in a very good position to fight what is now also partly likely to become a financial crisis as well as an economic one.
No, that is certainly true. But I think it is worth remembering that the object of policy at the moment has to be essentially to establish a bridge across this period where activity is depressed as a result of both this sharp shock to supply and the simultaneous sharp shock to demand. Supply because some workers have to be at home and things like that. Demand because consumers don't want to go out and shop and so forth. And the key thing is making sure that this hiatus period doesn't lead to permanent scarring on the economy, an adverse effect on the supply side. So what you want to avoid is businesses, perfectly viable businesses before the virus came along, going into bankruptcy and similarly lots of workers losing their jobs and so forth. So this is all about providing that bridge. And in that sense, it's a rather different task from what we were faced with in the Great Recession, where one was trying to boost demand, aggregate demand in the economy, to get consumers and businesses spending again. And there we were obviously finding ourselves running out of conventional weaponry and having to resort to things like quantitative easing and so forth. At the current juncture, I don't think that it's things like rate cuts and conventional QE, which are the key policy weapons at the juncture, conventional or orthodox monetary policy, given that QE is now sort of orthodox, because this is not about trying to stimulate aggregate demand at the current juncture. It's really about providing this bridge and ensuring that the financial markets continue to operate efficiently in helping provide that bridge to companies in the real part of the economy. So the measures that I think are important that we've seen taken in the recent past, I mean, I don't object to the cut in bank rate, but it seems to me that, first of all, the initiatives that were taken alongside the budget, introducing the term funding scheme for small and medium-sized enterprises, so this is a bit like the funding for lending scheme that we introduced back in 2012, that encourages banks to lend more to SMEs, reducing the counter-cyclical buffer to zero, which gives banks more capacity to lend. And then just in the most recent set of measures announced by the Chancellor, I think it's called the COVID Corporate Finance Facility.
This is direct lending, isn't it, to large and small companies through
the market? It's basically the bank buying commercial paper up to 1 year maturity. And in principle, I think that I assume that is entirely demand driven. There's no stated upper limit, I think, to the...
Indeed unlimited, isn't it? Do you think it's right that the Bank of England and the government hasn't yet resumed the what you might call the conventional quantitative easing, the wholesale purchases of government bonds? Because that would seem like the next shoe to fall. After all, there's going to be a huge amount of issuance by the Treasury. The borrowing targets have been put aside for the time being because there is going to have to be a tremendous amount of government borrowing. So the Bank of England on the secondary market buying up this paper would surely be helped from an interest rate point of view.
Well, how much borrowing there is, we will see. I mean, what the Chancellor announced, the 350 billion, of course, 330 billion of that is guarantees. And if the loans are all repaid eventually, then that doesn't involve any more actual borrowing. What there was 20 billion of grants, essentially, to smaller businesses, and that is an addition to borrowing. And I certainly could see a situation where if the period of hiatus, while these health-related measures are in force, extends for any length of time, then the need for grants relative to loans will increase. And the reason for that is if it's only a short period, it doesn't matter too much, particularly for big companies. They take out a loan. The debt's a bit bigger at the end, but they'll be able to pay it back. Might be more of an issue for small companies, which is why the Chancellor has focused a lot of his attention on providing direct financial support to SMEs and retailers, things like that, small retailers. But if this is quite a long period and people have suggested, well, this might last up to 18 months, the risk then is all you're doing is financing the bridge through loans. The businesses, when they come out the other side, are so heavily indebted, they can't really operate as normal. You've generated zombie businesses, if you like. So I would expect that the grant contribution, in other words, the implications of public borrowing, will probably increase from where we are, and possibly quite significantly.
What about the international implications, Charlie? Because this time round, 10 years ago or a decade ago, we did see a lot of international coordination with the Bank of England and the Fed and the European Central Bank, all acting in concert, all doing things on the same day. And then there was a spirit of the Group of 20 with a big fiscal response, including from China. This time, it's everybody doing their own thing. We saw the European Central Bank coming out last night in an unprecedented move in the middle of the night, basically, with new quantitative easing measures. We've had the Fed meeting on a Sunday, the Bank of England doing things before breakfast on one day. Everybody's doing their own thing. Is this somehow wrong? Because surely it would be better if everybody applied this bazooka in a coordinated way.
Well, it's not necessarily wrong. I mean, clearly, obviously, the bank's measures were designed to be coordinated with the Treasury. So, you know, there's a sort of joined upness internally, which was important. And there was coordination over reduction in policy rates, I guess. But you are absolutely right that there is less of the spirit of cooperation, which was there in 2007, 2008, 2009. I'm not sure there's any less cooperation between the central banks. I mean, the central banks will be talking through the medium of the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, and central bank governors will be letting each other know what they're doing, or at least they should be doing that. But of course, what may be the appropriate policy action by those central banks, because these are sort of more like liquidity support and credit easing operations rather than conventional monetary policy, they do inevitably need to be tailored to individual countries' particular circumstances, because financial market structures are different in the US from the Eurozone and in turn from the UK. So in the US, quite reasonably, the Fed has started reactivating the sorts of special bespoke facilities that it developed during the financial crisis, because you have a much more diverse capital market set up in the US. In Europe, it's much more bank intermediated, and all of the issue is supporting the core banking system, which can be done through more conventional lending support facilities by the central bank. And that's really what the ECB has done. And we're sort of, you know, a bit in the middle.
We have seen this run into the dollar, and there's going to be a big dollar squeeze on, and the Fed is doing all it can. You're right, there's been some international coordination on swap lines. And you mentioned the joined upness in this country, and it's true, we've got one government and one central bank. In Europe, in the monetary union, there is 19 different governments and one central bank. So you'd have thought that Britain would come out smelling of roses, really, with a more joined up response. Why is it that sterling has fallen so much, particularly in the last couple of days? It's now more or less at a 35-year low against the dollar. That might be understandable because money does tend to flow into the dollar at times of stress, but it's also fallen against the euro. So why is that? What's your theory?
Well, it is an interesting observation, and it does demonstrate that sometimes size may work to your advantage in terms of safe havens. And to be honest, I suspect that the past 3 years since the Brexit vote and the dysfunctional nature of British politics during that period, coupled with the fact that we still have to negotiate a final deal with the EU, it's not clear what that deal will be. The government says it wants a Canadian-style free trade agreement, but it's not impossible that we may end up exiting on WTO terms and the disruption that that would cause. So that may be in the back of investors' minds. The other thing, of course, should be said is that the UK has been running with a pretty substantial current account deficit, the order of 4% of GDP, for some time. And certainly if you take our forecasts at the OBR that were published alongside the budget, and they were predicated on a minor hit from coronavirus, analogous to the 2003 SARS epidemic. So essentially it was pretty much all contained in China. You know, we still had that sort of order of magnitude deficit persisting right throughout the five-year forecast period. And with a bad outcome to the trade negotiations, coupled with obviously what's going on with coronavirus, you could understand why some investors start thinking, well, you know, maybe the UK might not be such a safe place to keep my money. Let's stick with US treasuries or German bunds or whatever it might be.
I mentioned before that Mark Carney has just left. Your old colleague, who you know pretty well, Andrew Bailey, has just taken over. Today is his fourth day. What do you think of him as a person who's going to stand up to this unprecedented initiation ceremony, if you like? No other central bank governor in history has had quite such a warm welcome, I would say. How is he going to face up to all that?
Well, I have to say it is pretty remarkable. Of course, for an analogous case, you can look at Adair Turner when he took over the FSA, I guess it was, at the time, where he came in just as everything was collapsing. But it certainly is a baptism of fire. But of course, the great virtue of Andrew, and I have to say I was very glad that he was eventually appointed to the role, because he knows this territory like the back of his hand. I mean, he spent virtually all his career at the bank. He's been the governor's private secretary. People say he doesn't have experience in monetary policy, but when I joined the bank, he was the head of the international division in the monetary analysis side of the bank, my side of the bank, and was sort of the dominant division head. And he's sat in on MPC meetings as part of the minute-taking secretariat. You know, he subsequently went on to be executive director of banking, and then, of course, the Prudential Regulatory Authority when it was in its incipient stage before moving across to run the Financial Conduct Agency. So, you know, he really knows this territory.
Yeah, so just as well, really, that the government did choose somebody who is an absolute expert, not a word that the government sometimes likes to use. He does remind me a bit, in the way that you're describing him, of Steady Eddie, with whom, of course, you had a certain coalescence during your time. So he's a safe pair of hands for the job, you think?
Yes, I do. Absolutely. I mean, he's not only a safe pair of hands, he also knows the territory. The two things together, I think, are desperately important. And it is tempting for chancellors to, you know, appoint somebody who will turn heads at international meetings, or, you know, somebody who is deemed to have the right leanings on Brexit or whatever it might be. But the most important thing, I think, is that you have somebody who has the knowledge and skills necessary to run a central bank. And particularly if you come in right into the midst of a crisis, albeit that it's primarily a health crisis, which is having an economic crisis as a side effect. But I feel very much more comfortable with him in charge than really any of the other names that were being bandied about.
Good. Well, just a final question, Charlie. You are going about your life, it seems, relatively as normal. You're talking to me from the London School of Economics. I believe you're even going to give a lecture today, although you're not quite sure how many students will turn up, but it's being recorded. How long do you think this crisis will go on for? Everybody knows it's a health crisis and it's very difficult to apply an economist brain for this, but what does your gut feeling tell you? Will it be a short, sharp shock, or will it be something that will be with us for really still a very, very long period of time?
I think gut feelings are not the things to apply, because the key issue here, the key thing that will determine how long it goes on for, is the medical side of it, the epidemiology and how quickly a vaccine or antivirals can be developed. Now, if they're developed very quickly, so that, because, I mean, most people seem to think, well, the incidence of cases should start dying away, you know, after maybe another month or so. You know, pretty much the same trajectory as we've seen in China and then Korea. And as you get into the summertime anyway, the virus is expected to be less durable. Typically, these sorts of viruses don't like sunlight and warmer weather and so forth. But the expectation is that, you know, it will then come back again in the autumn, in all likelihood. Now, by that stage, there will be more people in the population who might have developed immunity, but there will still be the vulnerability of older people and people with bad health conditions and so forth. So, you know, if there isn't a vaccine and there aren't effective antivirals, by that point, we may be back with similar sorts of restrictions again. On the other hand, you know, we may have a vaccine in testing that might be applied at least to health workers, effective antivirals. The health service will have more ventilators, more beds, all that sort of thing. So we may be in a better position to weather it. So the real issue that will determine how long this goes on ought to be driven by the science, the medics of it. And the really key thing from an economic policy perspective is making sure that's really all there is, and that there is, as soon as the health crisis goes away, the economy can bounce back to where it was and start functioning again. It's almost like putting an economy in deep freeze for a while, and then when you thaw it, you want it to start operating straight away. We don't want to be in a situation where we've had lots of corporate failures, unemployment has rocketed, and it would take much more of an effort to get the economy restarted again. And that's incidentally when the demand management policies would potentially be important, as opposed to the more surgical, if you'll excuse the pun, interventions which are really being taken at the moment by both the Bank of England and the Treasury.
Good. Well, that points us to another chapter, doesn't it? As you say, once the surgical side of this has got away from the medical point of view, it'll be time for surgically administered demand management policies, perhaps. We will see. In the meantime, I hope you're booking up for your summer holiday somewhere, Charlie. You've not been put off by that. And I also hope your lecture goes very well, maybe with an absent number of people
well,
in the lecture
hall. I think my lecture could be interesting. We're LSE, we were in a sort of transition week. We had agreed, or it was decided by the school management, that we would be fully online from next week. We are towards the end of term anyway. There's only a couple of weeks beyond this week. But this week's sort of transition. I record my lectures anyway, I think most students a lot of them will probably already have travelled home at this point. Those who are still here probably won't bother to come in, but will prefer to watch it online. So my guess is I might be lecturing to an empty lecture hall, but it's the most efficient way to get the material recorded.
And what is the lecture on this afternoon?
Oh, funnily enough, it's on the financial crisis.
well, that will be a rollicking good fun, I should think. But at least it's not on the coronavirus.
No. My half of my lectures are on monetary policy and half on financial crisis and all of that. And the last two lectures, this is the penultimate one, the last two lectures are a sort of case study of the 2007 to 2009 crisis.
Good. Well, if this podcast does nothing more, I'm sure it'll stimulate even more demand for lectures by Professor Charlie Bean. So I'd like to thank you very much indeed. We'll be back again, I'm sure, with some more questions for you in the not too distant future when we see how this medical crisis is developing. But for the time being, thank you very much indeed, Charlie.